Okay, so I'm going to talk today about some story about how E. coli places its division site and how it decides where to place a division site. And so this is work that I've done with a student from MIT and an old colleague of mine, Igal Mayer. We're doing entirely theoretical work here. And fortunately, as you'll see as I give the talk, the experimentalists have done a superb job of characterizing this system. So it makes it possible for us to do what we do. So in outline, I'll give you an introduction to E. coli. You've heard a lot about it this week, so it's short, but anyone who wants to ask questions can ask questions, and there's a lot of expertise in the audience. I'll talk specifically about the placement of the division site. And there are two systems that regulate this. One called nucleoid occlusion, which is certainly there, but which the mechanism is really not understood. And the other is the one that I'm going to focus on, which involves a set of proteins called min proteins. And the sort of overall excitement about this is that these min proteins form a little spatial oscillator inside the cell. And the proteins are oscillating from one end of the cell to the other every 30 seconds. And I think this was very unexpected, and the first people to see this using GFP fusions probably fell off their chairs. So our interest here is going to be to model these oscillations, and if we can get some understanding of what's going on, to go on and make some predictions and some plans for experiments. One question which I'm going to address, but I'm not really going to answer, is why does E. coli need an oscillator? And there seems like there might have been other ways to address this, and I very much agree with the point of view of our morning speaker that the cell is very clever about choosing what mechanism it uses, and it often has a good reason, although sometimes the reason is obscure to us. It's worth thinking about. So by way of a brief introduction, here's an electron micrograph of E. coli caught in the act of division. And of course, what you see is it's a rod-shaped bacterium. It just grows longer and longer and then divides very accurately at its center. Of course, you know what a prokaryote is. It's got no nucleus. This is a gram-negative bacterium, has a wide range of habitats. Some of the interest in it, of course, is because there are pathogenic strains, and it's very helpful that it's one of the organisms that, with a known genome. So this part is clear. What was very surprising to me is how accurate this division is. People have taken the time to look closely and do the statistics on dividing cells, find that the division is accurate at this level. So if the cell runs from 0 to 1 with the average division site at 0.5, the standard deviation is only plus or minus 0.02. And this is actually fairly close to the limits of resolution. So it may even be dividing better than that. Something that one can image better than the actual division site is the placement of a ring of proteins called FTSZ. And this ring, which is believed to be a real polymer that stretches around the inner membrane of the cell, can be imaged by staining or by making fusions. And that appears to be even more accurate. So the placement of that ring is at 0.5 plus or minus 0.01. So for whatever reason, coli seems to care quite a bit about its accuracy with which it divides. So there are two systems that are known to be involved in the placement of this ring of FTSZ proteins. As I said, the first one is called nucleoid occlusion, and that's, as far as I can tell, pretty much, you know, saying everything that people know about it. The nucleoid is the condensed chromosome, and what people know is that where they can see the condensed chromosome, which is here stained red, you do not find FTSZ rings, which are here green because it's a GFP fusion. And the mechanism for that, as I said, is obscure, but it's extremely consistent, except in certain cases, and I'll show you some later, where by virtue of some mutation, this nucleoid occlusion isn't functional, and one can actually find FTSZ rings co-localized with the nucleoid. Now, a lot more is known about this other system, the MIN proteins. And so what I've shown here is just caricatures of a couple of the typical phenotypes you get when you start playing around with the MIN proteins. So one phenotype is called the mini-selling phenotype. And you get this if you knock out all of the MIN proteins. If you knock out all of the MIN proteins, presumably what you're left with is just nucleoid occlusion. And so, not too surprisingly, what you can find is that the cell will not form FTSZ rings and so won't divide where the nucleoids are. So the cell has doubled its chromosome and has now partitioned its nucleoids, they'll be here and here, and now the possible division sites are one near the center of the cell, but also division sites near the end of the cell. And so what one sees is that one gets some fraction of the divisions are more or less in the middle, but there's a significant fraction of divisions near the ends. And this is disastrous from the point of view of the cell, because there's no chromosome in the resulting mini cell, and so it's not viable. So it's a wasted cell division. The other phenotype that's quite common if you start playing around with MIN system is filamentous growth. For example, one of the MIN proteins, MIN-C, if it's overexpressed, is known to block the formation of the FTSZ ring. With no FTSZ ring, you don't get cell division. So these cells can be made to just keep growing. And the way one studies that is generally looking at some temperature-sensitive mutant or MIN-C that's under external control. And this is some septation minus mutant. Yeah? In general, one generally doesn't see that. One generally sees that that there's just one division. I don't think that's extremely well understood, although it's thought that possibly what limits this division is actually the availability of FTSZ protein, so that if it's forming in one place, there's not enough available to form somewhere else. So, there are only three of the MIN proteins, and you'll see in a little while that we're only going to concern ourselves with two of them. But we're stuck with two. We can't get away with just one. So MIN-C, as I've said, is an inhibitor of the formation of this FTSZ ring. But MIN-C is generally cytoplasmic, left by itself, and the FTSZ ring is forming associated with the inner membrane. And the way that MIN-C gets to the inner membrane where it can interfere with ring formation is it's recruited there by MIN-D. So MIN-D, it's an ATPase, so it binds ATP, and in the ATP-bound form, it associates with the membrane. And once it's there, it recruits MIN-C to the membrane. Without ATP, MIN-D is cytoplasmic also. So MIN-D binds ATP, goes into the membrane, recruits MIN-C, and therefore it can block FTSZ ring formation. So if you just have those two, all you get is what you'd expect. You get the membrane decorated with MIN-D bound to MIN-C, you block FTSZ ring formation, and so the cell filaments. But that's, of course, not the whole story. There's the third player now, MIN-E. So MIN-E is kind of like MIN-C in that it's cytoplasmic by itself, and it's recruited to the membrane by this MIN-D ATP complex. So you can think of the MIN-D going in, and in fact, there's evidence that MIN-C and MIN-E are competitive, that they're binding and that they're competitive in their binding to MIN-D. But MIN-E has a very different function. What it does is it induces hydrolysis of the ATP, which then ejects the MIN-D from the membrane. And so the question is, what happens when you put all three of these together? Yeah, this is. I'll show you this stuff. There's some beautiful in vitro studies of all this, not of what happens when you put all of these together, but of sort of the individual stories from Joe Lutkenhouse's group. And so you can see, and that's basically where these statements come from. They're coming from these in vitro experiments. Okay, but what happens when you put them all together is something that comes from in vivo experiments, and a lot of this is coming from Piet de Boer's work. So for example, here I'm showing some results on imaging of MindyGFP fusions. And what you're seeing here is not beautifully visible, but I think it's good enough. In the upper left-hand corner is the time in seconds. So the image shows that here's the cell. You can see it here in some differential contrast image. The cell is sitting there. As far as you can tell, all of the MinD protein is sitting at this end of the cell. And then as time goes by, some of it starts to reappear at the appear at the other end of the cell, and pretty soon all of the MinD protein is sitting at the other end of the cell, and then it oscillates back. And so this has a period of about 75 seconds. Wild type is thought to be closer to 30, but it's the same idea, that on a time scale much faster than the cell division, this MinD protein is oscillating en masse from one side of the cell to the other. Okay, so measurements on MinD are pretty consistent, that there are about, say, 2,000 MinDs in a typical cell. There's two different measurements of MinE, and I can only tell you that the more recent one says that there's something like 1,400. The earlier one said that there were a lot fewer. You'll see from our point of view that that doesn't matter particularly much. You can, the number compensates with the activity, and so, you know, you tell me how many there are, and I'm going to end up with essentially the same results. So an important observation here is that you can get these oscillations in the absence of MinC. You know, you won't get blocking of the FTSZ ring, so it's not going to work physiologically, but if you're just interested in the oscillations, MinD and MinE, along with an energy source, seem to be enough. Excuse me? So, okay, one thing I should say, that the MinC, from our point of view, is basically can be thought of as hitchhiking with MinD. So if you do imaging with just, say, a MinC GFP fusion, it'll look very similar to this. Basically, the MinC is where the MinD is. E absolutely oscillates, but it looks somewhat different. You'll see momentarily. So let me now go through sort of one by one some of what are the main phenomenology of these oscillations. So first off, let's look in detail again at that same picture of MinD, looking at the form of the oscillations. These are very, very consistent from one experiment to the other, that the actual details matter. So here you have MinD, and you can see by this sort of test tube-like shape that it's membrane-associated. So since you're looking at a projection view, it would look very solid if it was cytoplasmic. So most of the MinD is membrane-associated, and the oscillation is such that the MinD is concentrated in this polar region at one end of the cell, and it doesn't run across the cell. It just seems to move somehow where you're not spending a lot of time, because you don't image much in the center of the cell, and then it lands at the other end of the cell where it again starts to accumulate. So again, that's a very clear, consistent piece of phenomenology. And associated with that, and of course this has physiological consequences, is that if you look at where MinD is on average, it's at the ends of the cell, not in the middle. And that makes a lot of sense, certainly from the point of view of preventing mini-celling, because MinD recruits MinC, and MinC blocks ring formation. So by spending most of its time at the ends of the cell, the MinD is recruiting MinC and preventing mini-celling. But it's also clear that it's nearly a minimum at the center of the cell, where the cell intends to place its division site.
When you say gray, is the cell growing there?
The cell is, I mean, it's probably presumably growing a little bit, but this is only 75 seconds.
I don't know what you mean then by the polar regions grow in
depth. The polar regions of MinD, the concentrations of MinD are, you know, MinD is accumulating at the poles. Yeah. That's bleaching. So these things will continue to oscillate. And in fact, I'll show you a little bit. De Boer did an experiment on when he blocked protein synthesis, and these things were still oscillating 45 minutes later. So it's the same MINDI proteins that could just keep oscillating back and forth. Yeah, that's just a bleaching effect.
Just looking at the pictures, it seems that there's some sort of bulk transition between 50 and 55 at those times in seconds.
Yeah.
It's quite changed, but
yeah.
If you say 40 and 50, nothing happens.
Right, right.
And between 10 to 15, all of a sudden.
Absolutely. There is a fairly abrupt transition. I can tell you why that is. I think I'd rather wait to tell you why that is for a little while, though. I'll give you an answer which is correct, but probably will need some further explanation. And that is that the MINDI is actually cycling through one end cap, and it cycles many times as it starts to build up. And so the end caps actually compete for MINDI. So while the other end cap is small, there's a high probability that MINDI will cycle where it already is. But as you sort of pass through 50-50, there's a much greater movement because your probability of going from the end cap you're released from to the new one is now 50% rather than 5%. So you get this kind of what looks like a kind of rapid movement. Okay, that will probably make more sense later.
Have
yeah.
people quantified the oscillations, things like question of regularity of period, and also to what extent does it ever skip a period?
I think the answer is people have looked from cell to cell at how variable the period is. I don't know of anything where anyone has done anything systematic on a single cell about how much variation it is. And it'll be very clear that the period depends on the concentration of protein. So you expect a lot of variation from cell to cell. Okay, so next point was asked is what is MinE doing while this is going on? And there is a ring of MinE proteins that caps the MinD polar region. So let me show you that. So now these are images of MinE GFP fusions. And what you can see is sort of here is one part of the cycle. MinE is concentrated at one end of the cell, but it's not uniform. It's these two points here represent the fact that MinE is forming a ring around the membrane here. And as you see, the ring kind of moves and disappears. Then MinE is kind of spread out through the cell, and then the ring starts to reform at the other end and move. So the ring then moves progressively toward the end, and this cycle repeats itself. And what's known from cases where MinE GFP and MinD GFP are co-expressed is that this ring is sitting essentially at the outer edge of the MinD. So MinD is just going from one end of the cell to the other as a polar region, and MinE is capping only one of those MinD regions at a time, then moves to the other one.
So it's limiting it from spreading further? Is
that okay, so whether in fact it's limiting it from spreading further, I would say, you know, I can show you exactly what happens in a model, what the reason, you know, why the cell does it exactly this way. You know, that certainly makes sense that this is all organized to keep MINDI very low at the center of the cell. But I would rather wait, show you what one gets from modeling, and then one can later discuss could one have done it a different way and so on.
It doesn't move with MINDI.
I'm not sure what that question means. Try it again.
Well, if MINDI moves from one pole to the other.
Okay, so MINDI, it's absolutely clear that MINDI and MINE are not forming heterodimers or anything in the cytoplasm. No, they're associated on the membrane. Membrane diffusion is slow. So that movement of MINDI is a cytoplasmic diffusion of MINDI all by itself. And you'll see what happens late is that MINE will also diffuse cytoplasmically, but independent as monomers. And only in the membrane does the MINDI and the MINE associate. Yes?
So if you follow MINE, MINE, you don't see any effects?
If you, Well, if you knock out min-e, min-d has some cooperativity. So what you'll see is if you knock out min-e, you can find that min-d will exist as an end cap. And then 10 minutes later, you'll find that it's on the other end of the cell. But it's not. It's kind of stochastic. It's not forming exactly an oscillator. Yeah, it's clear that min-d, yeah, you do see changes. And
it is diffusion.
Min-d? You know, it's fast. It's got to move from one cell end of the cell to the other in a couple of seconds. I mean, there's no. I mean, I don't know, but we don't need to invoke any active transport mechanism. No, we do not invoke that. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So there's more phenomenology. I mean, the point is the experimentalists have really constrained this problem. So one knows also the behavior of the oscillation frequency, and what one finds is very consistently as you increase the amount of min-e, the oscillation gets faster. As you increase the amount of min-d, the oscillation gets slower. This is probably not all that helpful, but let me just show you. This is basically the data from De Boer. And so he's looking at various different strains where he's obviously labeled something in order to see the oscillations. And so if you just put in extra min-d on the chromosome, you get a cycle which is, you know, 90 seconds. But if you put min-d and e together in an operon the way they are in the natural chromosome, you get back down to what's the wild-type oscillation frequency of about 30 seconds. Then if you put even more min-d in by putting it on a plasmid, you get a very slow oscillation, 230 seconds. But again, if you put the e in with it, you get down to 30 seconds. So the basic phenomenology is the frequency looks like it's depending on the ratio of min-e to min-d. You can have them go up and down together and keep the same frequency. And here is this last point, that here is the experiment where protein synthesis is stopped, and 45 seconds later, these things are 45 minutes later, these things are still oscillating. So then one of the neatest pieces of phenomenology is what happens when you grow filamentous cells. So you grow the E. coli very long, what happens to these oscillations? And the cell turns into a zebra, essentially. So here's an image of a cell that's about 15 microns. This is an imaging min-e. And what you see is now there are two min-e rings coexisting. Now here, one at each end of the cell, and they're moving outward. So they're moving, presumably there's min-d here that they're progressing along with. And a little bit later, now the min-e rings have formed up around some central region and are moving in on that. And that's entirely consistent with what you see when you look at the min-d here in a very long cell, is that the min-d is now forming stripes. So here is the beginning of the cycle, the min-d is here in these regions, half a cycle later it's moved, and then it's moved back. So what's happening in the small cell, where you're sort of moving min-d from one end to the other and being followed by a min-e ring, sort of moving as the min-d disappears, now you just double that, and double that as the cell gets longer until you've got apparently as many wavelengths of this as you want. And there's a typical wavelength associated with this, which is about 10 microns. So a last piece of phenomenology is people have looked at mutants, and one of the more interesting mutants is some min-e mutants that don't have a min-e ring but can still oscillate. And this seems to be a general connection, that you can have cases where the min-e ring is visible or sometimes visible, and you can still get oscillations, albeit with a somewhat more diffuse min-d region. So here's a case where you have min-d, a rather diffuse polar zone, then it seems to be spread out, it's coming together at the other end of the cell and oscillating back, and these can be extremely slow. So this is a 10-minute oscillation, and it's in this case where you have this fragment of min-e where you've chopped off some of the C-terminus. And when you look at labeling that same fragment with GFP, you don't see any min-e rings. This is the fragment, and this is wild type. And it's still not entirely clear whether this particular strain is oscillating, but there's more recent data that suggests that you can have a mini ring. It can be very well defined with mutants. It can be less well defined, and then even gone. So one doesn't seem to see that the mini ring is essential. It's not as if the ring was a gasket that was somehow squeezing the min d together. The ring can be there or not be there, and one can still get some kind of oscillations. Okay, so this oscillations, as far as one can tell, just involve two proteins. And so it's a very tempting target to do some modeling. And of course, we're not the first ones to do some modeling on this. And so, in fact, I'm aware now of three different models looking at these min oscillations. And it's certainly the case that all of these models oscillate. No question about it. But the situation experimentally is much better than that. You know more than just that these proteins oscillate. I've tried to show you from the phenomenology, you know a ton about the form of these oscillations, the spatial form, the frequency dependence, what happens when the cells become long. And so the bar has been raised for modeling. And if you look at what the existing models have, they really can't account for the experiment. So they can say, yes, it's possible to build an oscillator out of two proteins, but it doesn't seem to be the right oscillator. So, for example, there's Howard et al. Again, they have a model. It's clearly involving min-D and min-E, but if you look at it, it's clear that the min-D polar region isn't forming at the poles. It's reforming near the center of the cell and then moving toward the poles. And Meinhard and DeBoer, and this is the DeBoer who did these beautiful experiments, they have a model that looks very good when you look at the images, but it's got some severe problems. I mean, in this case, all of the structures, the mini ring and the polar zone, are freshly synthesized protein. So the only way they get a ring is to, synthesize a min E. It goes into the ring, and then it disappears from the model. It's degraded or something. And, I mean, this is obviously contradicting the experiment that DeBoer did where he stopped protein synthesis. So, there may be some things that are right in this model, but overall it can't describe what's going on. And there's another model by Cruz, and I should say something about, I'd say sort of general, almost philosophical thing here. These first two models are basically as complicated as the phenomenon they're trying to describe. You see a mini ring. There's a term that forms a mini ring. You see some structure.
You say min-E.
I'm sorry, min-E.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yes.
So in some sense, they're getting out what they put in. You see something, you put a term in the equation, so that these models, have lots of terms, and you don't worry too much whether there's any, physical or experimental, observational underpinning for the terms you're putting in. You just put them in. In this case, you get the min-E ring by saying that min-E prefers an intermediate concentration of min-D. Well, you go from high level to zero, somewhere there's an intermediate at the transition, so min-E is looking for that intermediate. Well, there's no evidence, and there's no simple mechanism that would give you that, but you put it in and you get out a mini ring. Now, I think the model by Cruz, I think, is, much, it's sort of what you'd like to try first, at least. It's just to put in things that you really believe are there. That is, things having to do with the microscopic interactions of the proteins. And not put in a lot of things by hand and see how well you can do under those circumstances. And so he has a model where really all he has is that min-D is diffusing around in the membrane, and where there's more min-D, it seems to associate with itself, and that's known from in vitro experiments. He has the diffusion constant slow down. So it's a very minimal model, and from that minimal model, he gets oscillations. Now, there's no min-E ring, and so he has to say, well, if you want a min-E ring, you have to do other things. And the membrane diffusion seems to be much too fast to describe what's going on. But philosophically, he's trying to understand what's happening based on what's actually known from experiments. And I think that is certainly the approach one should take as long and as assiduously as possible. And one should only start putting in extra terms if one can't succeed with what's already known. And so we've taken the point of view of, let's see how far we can get using only interactions that are known from in vitro experiments. Yeah. Yeah.
Distribution between everywhere. I mean, it's almost uniformly distributed, right?
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you're going to go up the diffusion model, how does that relate? I mean, you either see it as one or the other, but now you've got this view, you see it distributed. Are you going to address that in the model, how you can get this distribution?
Yeah. So I'm. A lot of this actually does depend on concentrations. Like how much MND is going to be in the cell, whether one ends up seeing what's called a cytoplasmic burst or not. This is actually seen quite commonly, even in things which are not MinE mutants, that you'll see that there's accumulation of MND at one end of the cell, and then before you see the full accumulation of the other, there's kind of a cytoplasmic burst. Absolutely, by sort of playing around with parameters, one can get that burst phase to be a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. Specifically, what's happening in this particular mutant, I really don't know.
So part of that, I guess, getting it membrane bound versus cytoplasmic distributed would be important?
Sure. I mean, it would be nice to know, exactly, it would be nice to be sure whether this is cytoplasmic or membrane bound. I mean, it certainly looks to me to be cytoplasmic. And there's clear, I mean, it's clear again from what's known in vitro that MinD has a cytoplasmic phase. When it's not ATP bound, it's a cytoplasmic protein. So let me now tell you what the model is that we're using, give you some of the in vitro evidence, show you what we can get, and then talk about, you know, can we understand everything or nothing, or, you know, how far have we gotten? No, I haven't commented on that. It's certainly okay. I mean, all of the cells in this regime are showing oscillations. When you see the MinD, the MinE is forming a ring. When you see oscillations in more or less wild type cells, which have just GFP fused to something, you always see the MinE ring.
In the middle.
At the boundary of, well, what you believe is always at the boundary of one of the MinD polar zones. If there's only one, it's there, and if there's two, it's at the one that formed first.
But it's happening all through the cell cycle.
It's happening apparently all through the cell cycle, although it's quite clear that, you know, these things have a length dependence, and if the cell is too short, you know, you do not necessarily get oscillations. Now, that, I'm not clear exactly how much, whether there's any significant experimental evidence for that, but that is.
But the MinE ring determines where the plane of division
is. In fact, the plane of division is set by where the FTSZ ring forms. The FTSZ ring is inhibited by MinC, which is recruited by MinD, and the distribution of MinD depends very much on the presence of MinE. So there is a connection, clearly, between MinE and where the division site is, but it's not extremely direct.
I still can't see how the middle of the cell is defined, but maybe it's
not. Well, I think that you're not alone in that. There is certainly, as you'll see from this, a minimum in the concentration of MinD at the center of the cell, and whether you think that's enough or not enough, you know, you're in good company. It's not clear.
At what time in the cell cycle is the FTSZ ring actually?
The FTSZ ring is formed, you know, shortly before. That's the first thing that's formed, and then that recruits other proteins which eventually form the septum. So it's essentially after the chromosomes have doubled and segregated, then the FTSZ ring can form. So it's more or less right before cell division.
Just another question.
Sure.
Can you comment on the fact that the MinD minimum seems to be very shallow, because when you had the picture, the MinD was concentrating really at the end camp, And there was a considerable length along mm-hmm. the cell's body in which you could see no mean D. Therefore, what is defining there the middle? If it's so exact, it seems to be inconsistent with that.
Well, first off, you know, with those images, you don't know it. You're not seeing, it's not clear that you're seeing a one-to-one representation of MinD. There are saturation effects and so on going on. So I wouldn't say that there couldn't be a fairly well-defined minimum. In our models, we have sort of the opposite problem, that there's a minimum, but it's not extremely sharp. And I think that's a really interesting question. How do you really get this 0.5 plus or minus 0.01? I'm sorry, I'm not going to tell you that, but I will wave my hands a little bit toward the end. Okay.
Not because you don't want
to. Not because I don't want to tell you, no. I'd love to tell you.
This may be a theoretical question.
Okay.
You only talk about, everything is specific to E. coli. Is there a similar thing in eukaryotes with proteins oscillating around?
Okay, so I'm probably not the right one to ask about this. There are many homologs of MinD, this protein, so related family members. In some cases, it's known that these don't oscillate, but in a number of cases that people have started to look at, they have found, lo and behold, they do oscillate. So there are other systems. Now, MinD and this MinE system also exists by, you know, more or less identically in some other bacteria. But you could say that's just the same thing in some relative.
Okay.
But there are other, at least in prokaryotes, there are other things that oscillate, some involved in partitioning of plasmids, one in bacillus, right?
And do these oscillations?
There's SOG and SPOOGE that are oscillating.
In eukaryotes?
In eukaryotes, I don't know. I don't know whether there are oscillators in eukaryotes. It's possible.
There's
certainly temporal oscillations.
Oscillations.
Yeah. And then there are certainly a lot of things that have to do with, you know, shape and morphology and direction, and whether it's based on an oscillator or not, I don't know.
But I actually was curious about the role of
Yeah, well, I don't know if they exist. So I will tell you,
temporal
oscillations are all over the place. Yeah. I mean, I will speculate at the end why coli uses an oscillator, and then we can wonder whether this ever plays a role in eukaryotes. But anyway, so here's the model, and I'll show you right after it that every step here is, you know, based on in vitro measurements, you know, most of them done by Lutkenhouse. And it's not that we've put some new interpretation on them. This is exactly what the Lutkenhouse papers say. So MinD, you know, unbound to ATP, is cytoplasmic. So it's floating around in the cytoplasm. It binds ATP, and then it becomes competent to enter the membrane or to associate with the membrane. And in the membrane-associated form, MinD ATP polymerizes. So it clearly has some affinity for itself. And it's only in the membrane-associated form that MinE binds to MinD, and it activates hydrolysis of this ATP. So there's the MinE-MinD ATP complex. It activates hydrolysis, and while one doesn't see on a protein-by-protein basis this next step, it's certainly clear that in bulk, you add MinE to one of these polymerized MinD polymers, and it blows it apart, takes it off the membrane, and hydrolyzes it. So you presumably, at that point, separates MinD. The hydrolysis is not the same as separation from ADP, so there's got to be a step where MinD is ADP bound. Then it has to go back through MinD and back to MinD ATP. So all of these things, you know, are either observed or sort of have to be there by inference. You have to get rid of the ADP before you put on a new ATP. Well, that's right, because MinC is sort of a hitchhiker. It's doing its job, but it's following MinD, and it appears that it can only bind to MinD when MinE is not bound. But for the oscillations, you can get rid of MinC. It can be gone. So here's some of the in vitro studies from Lutkenhouse. So what he did was he reconstituted something that sort of looked like the cell using phospholipid vesicles. If you mix those with MinD that's not with no ATP, nothing happens. They just sit there and the MinD doesn't associate with the vesicles. But if you add ATP, this MinD-ATP complexes not only bind to the phospholipids, but they completely reshape these spherical vesicles into tubes. And this is where, you know, the PowerPoint would have been nice, but you can actually see striations here. And what's happened is that the MinD has formed a giant polymer. MinD ATP has formed a polymer that seems to be wrapped around the inside of this tube. It has a very nice diffraction pattern. It's a very regular, ordered structure. You add MinE to that, it hydrolyzes the ATP like crazy and blows apart these tubes. So what I'm going to do, and what comes next is say, well, okay, there's this model looked at, it's based on in vitro studies. Let's write down some equations just from that model and see what we can do with that.
I'm sorry, with that last step,
yeah.
You talked about two different things happening. Is there an order of events that you're proposing? Or
when you're talking about hydrolysis and disassembly? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would propose that this is a fast event, but I don't know that once
I don't know which happens first of those two things is what I'm getting at.
Well, there's no evidence for MinE and MinD associating the cytoplasm. So I think that they're associating on the membrane. So if you don't do something like the hydrolysis while you're on the membrane, there's no chance to do it later.
No, but I mean, the E could be making the polymers of D fall apart, and then that would stimulate hydrolysis, for example, or you could have it.
No, because because again, you could just mix MinD ATP and MinE together in the test tube without the phospholipid, and that doesn't activate hydrolysis to any significant extent.
On the surface of the lipid.
Yeah, but once it's on the surface of the lipid, and once they're forming there, you're constrained in what order you can do things. It's fine if you hydrolyze things, and then they can blow apart. But if they come off the membrane, we already know that they're not interacting. They're only interacting on the membrane.
So if I blow apart, I mean depolymerizing the D, not having it fall off the membrane.
I think this is different than I thought you were asking. Whether it depolymerizes and then comes off the membrane, I don't really know.
Whether it depolymerizes and then hydrolyzes the ATP, or vice versa, for example. I don't know.
I think that sort of arguing by analogy to other ATPases that polymerize, people think that it's hydrolyzing and then can actually. That starts some collective disassembly process, but the hydrolysis in some sense comes first. But I don't really know. I mean, I know just that. I can't tell you more. Yeah. Well, okay. So there's no. Okay. I mean, this is what happens, right? So there is no in vitro system. To see the full oscillations where the membrane would hold together. In principle, you'd have to get a confined system where MinD and MinE were both confined, and you could cycle ATP. You could get ATP in. But I understand that this actually can be done using photosynthetic systems. So maybe it is possible to do this in vitro, but that hasn't been done yet. So anyway, here's a lot of equations, but this is. If you were not unhappy with the model I showed as a picture, you shouldn't be unhappy with this because it's just it's just that same model. And so let me try to go through this, not belabor the point, but you have a bunch of species here, right? Because you have MinD in the membrane, you have MinD in the cytoplasm, you have E in the membrane and E in the cytoplasm, and you've got to follow all of these species. So here's sort of the basic mechanism, you know, that causes something to happen. It's here is the interaction of D with itself. So this is saying that I get D to go into the membrane because it starts out in the cytoplasm and it can stick at some background rate, but it sticks better if there's min D already in the membrane. So this is basically this polymerization. If there's D already there, D will tend to stick to it. And of course I get I lose D in the membrane when these DE complexes hydrolyze the ATP, and for me that's just one step. Hydrolysis and the E and the D come back out of the membrane. So this here's E in the membrane, and you're supposed to think that E is only allowed in the membrane in this model when it's stuck to a D. That's it. So you can think of these as DE complexes. And of course E gets recruited into the membrane by D, and it's only D that's available. So this is saying how much MinD ATP is stuck to the membrane locally that doesn't already have an E associated with it. And if an E in the cytoplasm bumps into that, it can stick and form a complex, and then at this same hydrolysis rate, they all blow back out into the cytoplasm.
Ned, why isn't that sentence from rho little E times rho little E
for the first equation? Which one? Here?
Yeah.
Well, this has nothing to do...
No, second term. Second term, that. Yeah.
Okay, these are assumed to be complexes. So anywhere you see rho E, it refers to a formed complex. All right, so now what's happening in the cytoplasm is that you...
There's different parts of the membrane.
In... Well, sure. I mean, there's lots of complications. So, from our point of view, in this model, membrane is membrane. So it's just all the membrane has the same properties. We don't pay attention to curvature or anything like that. And in principle, one could worry about complicated solutions. But we'll show you that we do this actually in a three-dimensional model where the cell is basically a can, is the shape of a can, and the membrane is the same properties everywhere. It seemed to me a reasonable point of view. What is it?
It's a two-dimensional manifold.
The membrane is two-dimensional. Yes, it is.
Sorry,
do
the space?
Yes, they do. All of this is now to be thought of as having space. I mean, this is probably a reasonable point to make now, that all the other models do this as the cell being one-dimensional, which seems very attractive. We'd love to do the cell as being one-dimensional. It turns out that when min E is released, it re-sticks to the membrane in a length that is typically short compared to the transverse dimension of the cell. In this case, you're sort of on mathematical grounds, you should not be modeling the cell as one-dimensional. And you say, well, math, schmath, you know, who cares? But it turns out that if you don't do this three-dimensional model, you don't get the zebra stripe oscillations in the long cell. So it really does matter. Terry?
You're kind of treating the polymerization as more like a polymerization kind of process.
Okay, so we're doing absolutely the most naive, simple thing. We just say, you know, there's a linear increase in the binding rate based on the local concentration of MinD. Obviously, if it polymerizes, there's all kinds of questions of open ends, how many ends are there, how does it form, does it then diffuse around, and we're... Apparently, when you let it sit for a long time, which Luckenhaus does, it forms this wonderful polymer that wraps around the inside of the tube. Well, you see the pictures, right? Now, what happens in E. coli, nobody knows, and it's pretty clear that this is not precisely what happens, that there are polymers and probably collective assembly and disassembly effects. But let's see what we can get, because I could put in anything I wanted for those terms. So I'm putting in the absolute minimum and seeing what you can get. Yeah?
I remember being at the 12 by 4, and for example, actually 4 equations, and was able to pretty much the same. I know that they were somewhat simpler, but
worthwhile, I mean, to make it more realistic but more complicated.
Okay, so I would throw out any equation here that was not needed to give you the right phenomenology. Okay, so first off, I want to insist, their model does not connect to reality in any way. They're the wrong oscillations. Now, you can then, but so that's one. But here you say, well, look at this. You've got a lot of species here. You've got, you know, DADP, DDATP. Maybe I should just get rid of those. But it turns out that that fact, that plays a critical role, that the recovery of MinD, once it's released into the cytoplasm, it's binding to ATP to let it be competent to rebind, is not a process with a single exponential decay rate. It has to have something that more like a clock. And the fact that we've based that on release of ADP and binding of ATP is just something that was convenient because it clearly happens in the cell. It could be that this, for example, step is very fast. You can ignore it, but that the release of ADP has a conformational change associated with it that makes it more like two steps. But sure, you know, we, in fact, obviously, you know, where we started out was with a 1D model with all kinds of wrong stuff in it. I mean, it's taken a lot of looking at the data and thinking about what's really happening to get to this point. But I'm not putting in things just to put in, you know, terms. These features are essential to get the observed phenomenology. Okay, so let me work through the equations just a little bit farther. So what happens, of course, is that I'm now looking in the cytoplasm. All of the species in the cytoplasm, D, whether it's bound to ADP free or bound to ATP, diffuse with some diffusion constant. E diffuses with some diffusion constant. This is old, you know, everything I'll show you, this is the diffusion constant, it's all the same. It's 2.5 microns squared per second, which was measured by someone for some cytoplasmic protein. So it's taken not for experiment on MinD and MinE, but on some protein in the cytoplasm. So those are just diffusion terms. And then you have the various sources and sinks for the various species. So when MinD comes out of the membrane, it's bound to ADP, so this is coming off the membrane, then it turns into MinD at a certain rate. MinD, of course, is then this term then appears in MinD, and that gets bound to ATP and disappears. This is then the source for MinD ATP, and then this MinD ATP is exactly the species that sticks to the membrane. So when it's lost from here, it appears in the membrane, and of course, you know, MinE in the cytoplasm is just balanced by what's happening to MinE in the membrane. So those are just, you know, it's just that model that I showed a picture of.
So you can impose detailed balance?
Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't say detailed balance because it's no. Detailed balance, no. This is highly non-equilibrium. There's a cycle here. I impose mass balance, you know. Proteins are conserved by these, yeah.
But the key thing here is that there's no diffusion on the membrane.
There is no diffusion on the membrane, but I wouldn't say it was key. We're just going to say that's sufficiently slow on this time scale of 30-second oscillations that it's not responsible, and we'll just ignore it. I'm sure that at some level it's happening. Okay, so first thing, you know, is you get an oscillator, right? I mean, if you don't get an oscillator, I shouldn't be talking here. So you get an oscillator, and it's a limit cycle oscillator. That is, I start with any old spatial configuration, and any tiny amount of noise in the system will rapidly drive this to its limit cycle, and this is looking at the concentrations of protein at the end of the cell, concentration of MinD at the ends of the cell, and then it'll just oscillate forever like that. So then, and again, this is not as visible as I would like, but we'll still work with it. So this is now looking at the cell, which is, remember, it's can-shaped, and what we're trying to do is to reproduce the kind of images that you get when you look at GFP. So what we've done is we've just taken a projection image of this can and look at where the proteins are. And so here, as you go through a cycle, you know, the MinD is sitting at this end of the cell, then it begins to accumulate around the membrane of this side. There it's a little more visible, so that there's now this polar zone which shrinks. And as this min D polar zone is disappearing, you can see that what's happening is that min E has formed a ring right at the boundary of this min D region. And the min E ring is following this boundary. Then the min E catches up with all of the min D, at which point the min D is now starting to accumulate at the other end of the cell, and this just repeats. So a few things to remark about the what to take away from this is that with these equations, min D grows as an end cap. It's not that it's running across or reforming in the middle and moving across. It's really reforming at, it's reforming at the far end of the cell. This min E is forming a ring. You know, there's no question there's a ring there, but there's no min E interaction in this. This is not happening because min E likes itself, and there's no min E trying to find intermediate concentrations of min D. Min E sees a min D, and it binds to it. Now, from the point of view of the physiology, indeed, yes, the min D is a minimum at the center of the cell. It's spending most of its time either at one end or the other. And one does see in some cases, again, this is really not all that visible, but there's some kind of cytoplasmic burst of min D here. You can, if you look at the right time, see a significant amount of the min D in the cytoplasm. Because, in fact, the only way min D moves is in the cytoplasm. It doesn't, once it sticks to the membrane, in the equations, at least, it doesn't diffuse at all. So there's the basic phenomenology of these oscillations. Now, you could also ask, okay, but you know, why does this oscillate? And that, I think, you know, is worth, you know, just waving my hands and saying, you know, what the basic idea is. And the basic idea is that in some sense, min D, when it comes out, say it's in this end cap here, min E is binding to it in this ring, and it's kicking the min D out. The min D is not competent to go back into the membrane. It has to release ADP and rebind ATP or something eventually to get to min D ATP. So it doesn't immediately rebind. So it can diffuse around again, and it has at least the possibility of diffusing far away from where the min E is. And I'll say more about why it ends up at the other end, far end of the cell. In contrast, min E, when it comes out of the membrane, is immediately competent to bind to another min D. So it's very sticky. So the min E comes out, goes right back in. So in some sense, it's sort of like predator and prey. The min D is the prey; it can run away. The predator, meanwhile, will just keep working its way through the local community of min Ds, hydrolyzing as it goes. And that's how you get oscillations. You get some sort of separation in the length, typical length for each species to restick. Min D takes a long time and therefore can move far away. Min E resticks very quickly. So it's that kind of that effect that lets this thing oscillate. And not surprisingly, you'll see that if you make the cell too small so that min D can't get away from min E, you kill the oscillations. Ah. Yes, that's great. Good question. For this range of concentrations, or what we were using, we do a linear stability analysis, and the cell has to be like 1.5 microns for oscillations to appear. Below that, it's stable. It doesn't oscillate. It's 1 micron in diameter. So, okay, good question. You know, diffusion does not usually shoot proteins from, you know, from one end of the cell to the other. The best you can get with just diffusion is to make things uniform. So why is the min D going from one end of the cell and sticking at the other? And so the mechanism for that is worth discussing, and it's I think it's an interesting question whether this may be more general than just this particular system. So here's my picture of a cell. Here's min D. It's in some existing end cap here. And you can imagine the min E is in a ring, and it's hydrolyzing the min D. And so, like I said, the min D pops out, and it starts diffusing around, and it takes some time before it binds ATP and is able to reattach to the membrane. So you can imagine that this, you know, diffusion with 2.5 microns squared per second is pretty fast, that the min D becomes uniform in the cell before it has time to rebind ATP. And in fact, it matters that it doesn't just immediately start binding ATP, that it has a distribution of waiting times that looks more like two processes in series actually is important, not for a normal size cell, but this turns out to be important to get the behavior right in the long cell. But there's some mechanism that slows MinD down so it doesn't immediately go back into the membrane. But you're saying, well, you know, okay, that's exactly what I thought. MinD becomes uniform in the cytoplasm. But that's not quite what I said. I said that the source MinD ATP is uniform in the cytoplasm. But you've got to consider not just the sources, but you've got to consider the sinks. And the point is that this old end cap is extremely sticky for MinD ATP. So as soon as the MinD ATP reappears in the cytoplasm, the stuff at this end of the cell immediately re-sticks to the old end cap. And so if you wait then and look a few seconds later, diffusion will have created a distribution in the cytoplasm that has actually peaked at the far end of the cell. And so I have my favorite analogy to this. If you start with a room full of flies, and they're uniform, they're flying around inside the room, and then at time equals zero, you turn one wall into fly paper. And then you wait a minute, and you come back and you look at the room. And what you find, of course, is that there are a lot of flies stuck to the fly paper. But if you look at the flies that are flying around, there are very few of them near the wall that's made of fly paper, and there are lots of them at the other wall. And that's exactly what's happening in this case, that where MinD ATP in the cytoplasm is the flies. So there's a lot that get restuck to the fly paper, which is the old polar zone, but what's left in the cytoplasm is concentrated or peaked at the other end of the cell. That is distribution that then starts sticking to the bare membrane. So you get more sticking at the far end of the cell than in the middle. And of course, then there's this nonlinear process that once the MinD starts sticking, it's very sticky for more MinD, and so you build up then an accumulation at the far end of the cell.
That sounds very odd. I can't understand how diffusion doesn't just equalize all the time.
No, because you've got a sink. You see, you've got this is constantly eating up any MinD ATP.
Source, right? That's also where the MinD ATP.
No. The source is uniform because MinD has to wait until it's it binds ATP.
So it's continually being taken up.
Yes, it's continual, it's cycling. In other words, in the typical oscillation, a MinD will go in and out of this end cap five times before it ends up sticking at the other end of the cell. I mean, that's certainly true in our model. If you look at the GFP cases, you can see that the end caps are getting more intense as they're shrinking. So there's clearly some process that's concentrating, that's moving the MinDs around. Our view is it's exactly the same. It's that it enters, it cycles. The MinDs go into the cytoplasm, diffuse around, they bind ATP. Many of them, all the ones from this end of the cell, say, re-stick, and only if that leaves an excess of MinD ATP at the far end of the cell, and that's what nucleates the new polar zone. I didn't say it wasn't complicated, but, you know, but that's or, well, you get used to it.
But it seems like some of the time it ought to stick somewhere in the middle.
It does. Nucleate,
there.
You do. You do get, I mean, absolutely. It can stick in the middle. And we do see that, you know, on average, it's not that there's zero concentration in the middle. It's just that how do you get it to, you know, preferentially come to this end of the cell, not that you get zero in the middle. I mean, here's the distribution, right? Here's the length of the cell from 0 to 4. This is a suppressed 0. So you get maybe a factor of 2 increase. So as you look in what's in the cytoplasm from here to there, it goes up by a factor of 2. But then that starts sticking, and this sort of blows up where you have the rich get richer. You know, as it starts to stick. Yeah, right. So that once you get a little bit more stuck to the membrane here than in the middle, this becomes then a very sticky region and starts getting more and more.
So I'm in the
ADP? Yes.
I have to wait until I become a MinD, and then I have to wait until I get ADP.
Yes.
By that time, you claim I'm equally likely to be anywhere in the cell.
That's correct.
Okay. So then, the moment that I become sticky, I'm equally likely to become sticky anywhere in
no.
the cell.
No, no, no. So because the bare membrane is not very sticky. The bare membrane, I can bounce on the bare membrane many times. It's this region that's sticky.
I'm much more likely to stick than if I happen to be on the right side.
That is correct.
I'd still be equally likely to stick on the top end on the right side.
No.
You're telling me that I'm equally likely to appear there as on the right side.
Yeah, but if you appear, look, if you appear in the middle and you say, where am I going to stick? Well, I'll bounce around a little bit a few times. But if I hit this region, I'm stuck.
You say you don't stick the first time you hit the membrane?
Absolutely. No, right, absolutely. The bare membrane is not very sticky, so I can still bounce around a few times. If I hit this end, I'm out of the game, and so it's only the guys over here are much more likely to end up stuck to fresh membrane than the guys that appear over here, which are much more likely to stick to the old membrane. Yeah. If the membrane was perfectly sticky everywhere, this would, of course, not work. I did. Although how I know that is a good question. I know that if you, yeah.
Good. You might guess. I don't know if it's built like a diffusion. If you might guess that you double the diffusion constant going from GFP to GFP, so is the frequency.
You know, that's not entirely clear. I mean, right. It turns out that what the diffusion of min-D affects is only at the wavelength. It doesn't affect the oscillation frequency. So in the short cells, it's not going to matter. But one could ask that question for longer cells, for the filamenting cells. Yes?
What confuses me is that I thought min-D actually recruits min-D to
the... Oh, we have... Yeah. You know what? I lost you in the middle there. I apologize. Try it one more time.
How many min-D in one? And I thought that min-D in the original model is what is recruiting min-D.
Absolutely. No, the min-Ds are not competing with min-Es for sticking. You know, min-D forms this polymer. So this is just a min-D story, right? I mean, our point of view is that min-D sticks to other min-D independent of whether min-E is around. And we don't know this, but it seems at least possible. And in general, there's less min-E than min-D, so the min-D is not saturated. But I think, you know, one aspect of this, which is exactly what comes next, is like, where does this ring come from, right? You know, you saw the ring, but we've got how you form polar zones, but where is the ring coming from? So the ring is, again, coming from a kind of dynamical effect. It's not from a special term in the equation. It's just this is how the oscillations play out. So the idea is, you know, how does this ring get here? Well, what's happened is that min E has, remember, concentrated at the old polar zone. It's very greedy. It will stay there until all of the min-D is now hydrolyzed and ejected from this old polar zone. Meanwhile, the min-D has been forming up this new polar zone in the absence of min-E. So what happens is now the min-E is nothing to bind to. It becomes cytoplasmic, and it starts diffusing across the cell, and it then starts to stick to the first min-D it finds. It's very sticky. And of course, since it's coming from the left, and there's a nice end cap of min-D, it sticks near the margins of that and just forms the ring dynamically. You know, and you can see why the ring, you know, if min-E was diffusing a little bit faster or was a little less sticky, we wouldn't form a ring. The ring, the morphology of the ring depends on these properties. It wasn't necessary that it be there to get oscillations, but if min-E is sticky enough and diffuses slow enough, you form a ring. I'm dying. Well, okay, I realize I have no transparencies on the sphere. So I don't know. Do I tell you about the sphere right now? Let me tell you. Okay, sure, I'll tell you about the sphere right now. It's always answer a question. That's my role. So among the other prokaryotes that have min proteins is Neisseria gonorrhea, which is not a rod-shaped bacterium. It's a spherical cell. It's a coccus. Or maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's a spherical cell. And no one has been able to do, as far as I know, the GFP fusions to look for oscillations. But you can do a lot. So you can knock out the min proteins, and it's clear that these cells have division defects. You know, you look at them, and they're just messy. There's big halves and little halves, and it's a mess. You can do more than that. You can take the Neisseria min proteins and make GFP fusions, insert them into coli, and they oscillate. So they're, you know, it looks pretty much like they're doing it, but you've got spheres. So what we do is we just say, well, look, we have not given ourselves a lot of wiggle room here. It's not that we got a one-dimensional model and then, you know, who knows what to do the sphere. We're doing this thing in three dimensions with diffusion and membrane. We just take our can and now we, you know, deform it into a sphere. So we study the sphere. And, you know, this is one of the things that reassures me most. We get oscillations. So even though this thing was, you know, developed looking at the rod, you take the same proteins, because all the same parameters, put them in a sphere, you get oscillations. You don't get a mini ring. There's not, that's, that, you know, you can sort of understand from the geometry that you're not going to get a very clear ring, but by God, you get oscillations. And then, you know, okay, I'd have to say that it's pretty clear that the people working in the field expect you to get oscillations, right? I mean, all the proteins are there, they oscillate in coli. But one thing that might not have been obvious is that may not be true, but it's a prediction that just like in coli when you filament it and you start getting multiple wavelengths, when you grow the sphere larger, you start getting multiple wavelengths of the min protein oscillations. So the sphere starts to act like a zebra. Okay.
Early in the talk, I asked you about those pictures that you showed with time. And it looks like nothing is happening for a while, and suddenly something happens.
Yeah.
But the curves you're showing up have very nicely irregular sinusoidal.
Those are the.
Show the abrupt.
This one.
Yeah.
Well, that's not really quite sinusoidal.
It was nicely smooth.
Well, it's smooth, but, you know. But that's kind of what's happening, right? I mean, it's not sinusoidal. It's small, 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 and then it accelerates. So there is a little bit of that in this. I have to admit, it's not something that we've quantified, but I can work on that. I don't know, but I think it does actually have something of an accelerating behavior. Yeah. Well, you know, here's 100, and well, this is something like 40 seconds or something like that. I'm just going to do this now. What controls the frequency? So what controls?
Sorry.
Yeah.
For your spherical material.
Yes.
Do you expect this thing to rotate?
We do. And of course, what we do is we solve these mean field equations. So, of course, you give it some initial conditions, it picks out an axis. So what we're doing now is we're actually doing a particle simulation. Each protein is a particle, they diffuse around, they nucleate, and we'll see. I mean, one expects, as you say, you'll oscillate some direction and it will drift. But I think that in order to get some handle on that, you've got to go to the real discrete protein limit. If you know a better way, I would be interested. The cells in Neisseria, they divide along a particular, you know, once, you know, we have one cell and it can remember, you know, it divides and then it can remember where it divides. And it's, so it kind of starts out in life as an oblate spheroid, and that picks out at least one axis, which is one axis not to oscillate on, and then pick out another one.
Does it divide into middle?
Neisseria, yeah. I mean, I quantitating that is not something I'm aware of anyone has done, but close to the middle. Okay, so what determines the oscillation frequency here? Well, you know, you pretty much got it by now. Min E is hydrolyzing min D at some rate. And so the more min E you have, the faster that hydrolysis happens. And the more min D you have, the more there is to hydrolyze and the slower it happens. And so the frequency is really just determined by this ratio of min E to min D. More min E is faster, more min D is slower. And you can see that, you know, you get, as you change the concentrations, you still get oscillations over some considerable range of concentrations. And it's more or less simply just dependent on this ratio. With one limit, that you can't get the oscillations too fast. If you put in, say, too much min E, eventually it just kicks all the min D out into the cytoplasm and the oscillations are dead. So
it doesn't enter.
Well, again, I mean, that's sort of this, I mean, it's sort of the fast limit. At the fast limit, you start to run into how long the min D takes to bind ATP, or I think that's actually slower, but. Look, this is per unit length, it turns out. So, 4 micron cell, this is probably wild type here.
But it's like this predator prey. If you have too much EEs, then predator will eat all prey and nothing will be left.
Exactly.
So there should be a least order of magnitude between mean E and mean E. And your experimental data was your 2014.
Okay. In fact, yes, it's worth remarking that people think now that min E acts as a homodimer. And so that 1400, we actually divide that by a factor of 2 for the active species. And it's true that, I mean, you could get oscillations to work by tuning down hydrolysis rates and so on, but it's sort of, the regime that I think is most relevant is where min D is never saturated by min E. Okay, ours will just sit there, because in our case, the min D, once it's in the membrane, it doesn't diffuse, and without min E, it never leaves. Now, you could put in a very slow background hydrolysis rate, at which point, at some very, very slow period, min Ds would individually come out, most probably restick, but with some probability stick to the other end of the cell, and the same concentrating mechanism would apply particle by particle. So you would get, with a slow background hydrolysis rate, a slow movement of the min D from one end of the cell to the other. But it would be rather diffuse, because there's never, the min E would never be around to clean it up in the middle. Yeah. Actually, that's something we haven't actually looked at, the morphology specifically of doing that, of putting in a background hydrolysis rate. I think that's a great idea. It would be fun. We will do it. Yeah. That's correct. If we let the min D sticking coefficient continue to increase linearly with min D concentration, you can get to a regime where min D is sort of infinitely dense and infinitely sticky. But that we just haven't played around with that. Presumably, there's a maximum density of min D once it polymerizes, and even then can't stick anymore. I didn't want to go there, but yeah, there should be, in our model, for sure you run into problems with too much min D. In reality, it's not clear whether just the polymer formation, prevents this kind of catastrophe.
But at a certain point, the thing has to switch from one pole to the other pole, so the new pole must be more attractive.
Well, this happens bit by bit. I mean, particle by particle. Even if your probability of going to the far pole is only 1 in 10,000, if you wait around long enough, eventually that new pole will nucleate and start to grow. Let me keep pushing on, because I've got like one more thing that I really want to show you, and that is, you know, the zebra. So if one now just makes the cell longer, then the oscillations are no longer is this sloshing from side to side, the limit cycle, but the stable solution is now something that has two simultaneous existence either of two MinD end caps or this MinD tube in the middle. And as you can see, that the, you know, the MinE is doing what you'd expect. It's following the both of these end caps, and when the MinD is forming a tube in the middle, the MinE is concentrated at rings around its edge, which then move in as they hydrolyze the MinD, which by essentially the same mechanism as before, since now this region is sticky and is the sink, the MinD in the cytoplasm becomes maximum at both ends, and you get reformation of these end caps. And it was getting the sort of oscillation pattern with multiple wavelengths we found that was really required this full 3D treatment and this more clock-like recovery of MinD ATP. Okay, just... It's exactly. It's exactly. It's sort of how far MinD goes before its clock, you know, chimes.
So these aren't stable stripes. They're coming and going.
This is time.
That's what I mean. So they're coming
together. Yes. Yes. It's in that sense. It's unlike a zebra.
That's what we biologists.
But maybe if you watch a zebra for a very long time.
What guarantees that the concentration of MinD at the end of your zebra are they just in phase?
It is in phase. If you start, this is a limit cycle. You started out with some weird concentration, and very quickly it relaxes to this symmetric solution. And what you can see is, well, just this business of this mutant, which, you know, I just wanted to make the point, we don't really understand the mutant, but there's the MinE ring is sort of something that could be there or not, depending on how fast MinE diffuses and sticks. So here is some picture of, you know, different time slices, and there's MinE ring, and you see it. And now you increase the diffusion coefficient of MinE, and there's not really a ring anymore. It oscillates from back and forth, but there's nothing that you would call a ring. So the ring arises dynamically, and it can be gone if you get out of that regime. You know, it wouldn't be complete without saying robust. So these are robust oscillations. They're a limit cycle. You know, you can't shake the cell and then it, you know, stops oscillating. It will start oscillating again. And you do see at least that it oscillates for a wide range of parameters. At least factors of three, sort of in each of these concentrations, will keep oscillating. And indeed, you know, these are on an operon. So the coli does seem to care about the ratio of D and E. Okay, so we have some predictions which should now, you know, be expected. This is, yeah.
Except the robustness, there's a difference for robustness, right? I mean, in the sense that the oscillation frequency isn't particularly robust, and you don't care.
Right.
And
right.
What's really robust is the null point, which is what you really care about.
Absolutely. It cares about some things and not about others. And it does want to keep oscillating, right? Keep on trucking.
But that's very robust. The oscillation frequency isn't particularly robust. It doesn't need to be.
And doesn't need to be. And in fact, what you can see is that up until around 200 seconds, As long as its oscillation is faster than 200 seconds, it prevents mini-celling. If it gets much slower than that, apparently the MinD and MinC spend so much time at one end of the cell that it gives the FTSZ ring time to form at the other, and you start getting mini-cells. So one prediction, which will be, you know, a challenge to measure because of the involvement of the membrane, but is that the MinD release of ADP and rebinding of ATP is kind of a clock, that it has... It's more like two processes in series than just one decay. And this turns out to be important. Otherwise, you get the source of the MinD ATP is at the wrong end of the cell. And this kills this effect of giving you accumulation at the far end. But again, it's not clear that it's ADP release and ATP rebinding. It could be some conformational change. What sets the rates here? Clearly, how fast the mini hydrolyzes min D is what's determining oscillation frequency. So any way you play around with that, either with mutants or with concentration changes, is going to affect the oscillation frequency. And the diffusion length of min D before rebinding is what sets the wavelength. So again, this is something one could look for in experiments. Well, we don't, no one knows any of these parameters. That's the problem. You have mutants, and they're mutants of min E. People, Rothfield group has studied a bunch of min E mutants. And right. And that's hard. I mean, it's hard because you've got, in order to go through its cycle, it's got to go associate with the membrane, then come out. So you can't just mix min D and min E and look at it that way. But there's certainly a connection between morphology of min E ring and min D end caps, which we've looked at and at least seems consistent with the experiments, but I don't want to go there. There are lots of open questions here. I mean, there's sometimes you see weird things happen. Like here's the min E ring, it's doing its job, it's moving toward the right, whoops, it starts moving back toward the center of the cell and it reverses. So, I mean, it suggests some kind of collective assembly and disassembly of polymers going on, but I have no real handle on that now, so we haven't tried to do anything with that. But it's real, it's happening, and maybe it plays some role in the physiology. As I mentioned, min E seems to dimerize. We've just said, okay, you think min E dimerizes, we'll put in min E as dimers. But whether this has some larger effect of letting min E stick to the min D, there's no evidence for that, so we didn't put it in. Okay, so now let me take the last like 3 minutes or something and say something about why is this solution, right? Why this way and not some other way? And just to show you that there are other ways, Subtilis also has a problem with mini-celling. If you don't have it has min-CD homologs, and if you knock these out, you get mini-cells. So it has a problem with mini-celling, and it solves it with min-C and min-D, but it doesn't have oscillations. It has static polar regions where min-D is directed toward the poles of the cell during when the cell divides, and min-C is recruited there, and that blocks FTSZ ring formation, prevents mini-celling. Static solution. So let me then just make a remark, because I don't have all of the... I don't quite have everything I want, but you'll just have to take my word for it that when people have looked at the accuracy of cell division in Bacillus, it is not as accurate as in coli, by about a factor of 5. So Bacillus, of course, has this whole other story of sporulation, and that may be important, but even when it's not sporulating, it is less accurate in dividing. And so...
just have to explain to us why the oscillating system makes it empty.
Wonderful question. The reason that I hypothesize that you need an oscillating system is to deal with concentration fluctuations or protein number fluctuations. Because imagine that you wanted in Bacillus to find the middle of the cell, and you had each end of the cell was decorated with min D and min C, so you had two distributions which were coming together and had a minimum at the middle. But if there was more on the left end of the cell, then that would shift the apparent center. Well, if you build an oscillator, you're using the same set of proteins on the left, and then half a cycle later, you're using the same set of proteins on the right. And if you're looking for the minimum and you're able to average over time, then you're insensitive to overall number fluctuations of your proteins, because it's the same guys on the left at the beginning of the cycle as are on the right at halfway through the cycle.
If you were in the cell, how the hell would you know where the middle was?
Because you are somehow
going up and down.
No, but you let's say you're in the cell and you're trying to form an FTSZ ring. And you just care about the time averaged concentration of min C in your environment. So you're able to do some time averaging, some integrating.
That will give you the center.
That will give you the center. Now, can you really get this 0.5 plus or minus 0.01 based on this? Who knows? But here's at least throwing out for consideration how an oscillator gives you something, which is some kind of robustness to number fluctuations. So there's other things that could be going on here. This business of growing filamentous cells is not entirely a laboratory artifact. The E. coli, when one induces the SOS response with UV radiation or something along those lines, grows filamentously and then recovers. And it's possible that this patterning of the cell into nice cell size segments by the min proteins actually plays a role in recovery. So that's certainly something worth thinking about.
What about mutants in the min system in the SOS response?
What about it, Tom?
So what happens to the accuracy in min mutants?
In min mutants.
So the accuracy decreases by some type of.
I was wondering whether to show this. You've decided me. So this is something not about the division site, but the FTSZ ring placement site. So it's just as good. And here you see this is wild type. And this is 0 and 1, and this is 0.5. This is the length of the cell. And you see some spread, but what you might not be able to see is that it's binned, and there's this solid line right here, which is within the central bin. That, you know, most of the time, coli is dividing right down the middle. So this is in a wild type. You now knock out the min protein, so you get mini-celling. So there's some mini-celling. But most of the time, it still divides in the center, but with nothing like the same accuracy. So this is the nucleoid occlusion. So the nucleoids are presumably sitting here and there, and nucleoid occlusion by itself is not able to give you this accuracy. The question, and this is something that Tom and I are puzzling about how to do experiments on, is can you imagine getting rid of the nucleoid and seeing if the min protein still give you this accuracy?
The argument. So it's good to oscillate because you're basically making several independent measurements. So what number, the number of cycles in one division, right, which is what, about 50 or something.
Yeah.
Right? So square root of 50. Right? So now change, suppose you can find a mutant that divides four times, that oscillates four times slower. So the accuracy should go.
It's possible. Yeah, but if it's too much slower, you know you kill things. I mean, you're looking at they're subtly different. I mean, the total integration time is a little different from this question of is the minimum actually at the center. Yes. Diffusion rates? You know, I mean, nobody knows the diffusion rates of the min proteins. This 2.5 micron squared per second was measurements on a cytoplasmic protein in E. coli. So. Yeah.
Because really slow down the growth rate.
Yeah, you don't want
to make the cell size much smaller.
Yeah.
Right.
Deal with that problem.
Okay.
If you could do that, that would be. Well, the problem is also.
You know, I think you're putting words into my mouth here. I've said there's a model. I'll tell you, you know, I'll tell you that the equations we wrote down there have the solutions we wrote down there. That, you know, I will tell you. I also have a speculation that an oscillator has this one property that time average, the minimum is can be more accurately the center of the cell than some static solution. Now to say what happens when I stretch things out over longer times and so on, this depends on dynamics of FTSZ ring formation and all sorts of more complicated businesses. Okay, so I think we're there. I've already told you about the spheres, so this is it. One thing, you know, which the experimentalists have made clear is that the division site placement in E. coli is regulated by these min proteins, and they oscillate from pole to pole. If you believe nothing else, you should believe that. We've written down a simple model based on observed in vitro properties, albeit with a lot of parameters that we had to put in by hand, but at least the interactions are known. And we were able to reproduce these central features of the phenomenology. These min-dipolar regions are growing at the ends of the cell. There's a ring of min-E that forms at the edge of the min-dipolar region. There are no targets at the end of the cell here. There's no min-E interaction required there or gradient finding. The oscillation frequency follows the observed dependence on the ratio of concentrations. And if you grow the cell long, it starts to look like a strobing zebra. We're working now, Tom and I are talking about experiments that you could do to test what this is really accomplishing and whether it plays a role in the division accuracy and in this SOS response. So, thanks.